final investigator interviewed for this program was Dr. Neil Maripol, who began our conversation by commenting on a data set in early colon cancer he recently presented.
At the GI Symposium in January, we presented our work in which we attempted to model the use of a gene expression profiling tool in terms of how the use of such a tool in stage 2 colon cancer would affect the use of adjuvant therapy and affect patient outcomes and costs. And the reason I got into this was that right now, the adjuvant therapy of stage 2 colon cancer represents a challenge for all of us. We have some sort of crude clinical parameters that we tend to use to help us select whether to give adjuvant therapy. But even in the best circumstance, we still are dealing with a situation where we have to treat a lot of patients to save a few lives. And we're all hungry for a better method for selecting those patients who really will benefit a lot from adjuvant therapy. So we're in this era now where there are a bunch of new platforms being developed looking at gene expression of colon cancers as a way to predict which tumors are going to relapse and which are destined to never relapse. So there's one platform that's commercially available now, which is the Oncotype DX for colon cancer platform, which is a 12-gene expression platform that predicts risk of recurrence at 3 years based on a study done on archived material from the European QUASAR study. And we tried to ask the question, if you use a gene expression profile like this to select patients for adjuvant therapy, will you come up with a different pattern of care, a different answer, if you will, than if you use the typical clinical parameters like number of lymph nodes examined, lymphovascular invasion, whether it's a T4 tumor, and so forth? So we developed a model, which we call a Markov model, which cycles a imaginary patient through various health states, one being a pathway, if you give adjuvant therapy, what are the side effects, what's gained, what's lost, and then another pathway being, you know, what if you don't give adjuvant therapy? And what we compared was the use of clinical parameters to make an adjuvant therapy decision versus the use of a gene expression profile to make an adjuvant therapy decision. And what we found is that if you use the gene expression profile and base your decision of using adjuvant therapy or not on whether an individual patient will gain or lose quality-adjusted survival. So it's not only length of life, but it's also the quality of life in your remaining life years. Whether using a gene expression profile, a prognostic assay, will actually improve the number of quality-adjusted life years or decrease them. And what we found was that if you use a gene expression profile like this, you'll actually give 17% less patients chemotherapy. So the use of chemotherapy will actually go down by 17%. And at the same time, overall, over the whole population of stage 2 colon cancer patients, in our model, there was an increase in quality-adjusted survival associated with a decrease in chemotherapy use.
So let me ask you, as you said, this assay has been around in breast cancer for quite a while, but now it is available in colon cancer. Are there any situations where you'll send it on a patient outside of a trial setting?
So right now, the most valuable time to use an assay like this is in a patient who is in that middle ground where you really don't know whether to treat or not. The patient who doesn't have a T4 tumor, because most of us would offer adjuvant therapy to those high-risk stage 2 patients with T4 tumors. And then there's this low-risk patient group that we haven't talked about yet, and those are the patients who have evidence of deficient mismatch repair. We know those patients are destined to not relapse for the most part, a very low recurrence risk, and those patients shouldn't get adjuvant therapy. So we're dealing with the other group of patients in the middle. And in that group of patients, if there is a question of whether a patient might actually choose to take chemotherapy, if they were among the patients in that group, that intermediate risk group who might be at the high end of risk, even though that risk is still not tremendous, if that individual patient who says, well, you know, I'd take therapy if it would improve my survival by about 3%, then that might be a situation to order the assay right now.
So our group and others have documented the frequent use of the Oncotype DX in breast cancer. I mean, it's part of practice. Seems like it changes what people do maybe a quarter, a third of the time. I mean, it's just amazing. It's become part of practice. Do you see this assay in colon cancer or others similar to that? Do you see moving forward? This is, again, selectively, breast cancer, it's also been for people on the fence. But do you think this is the way forward?
This is definitely the way forward. The problem is that among the patients that we're now considering to be at intermediate risk, the risk is still pretty small among all those patients. And it's still, even with the use of a prognostic assay, there's still a big chunk of patient preferences that really bears on whether or not adjuvant therapy is ultimately selected. So even among this intermediate risk group, the patients at the high end of risk, it's still not such a high risk level that you would say, I would definitely treat all of those patients. So there's still a judgment call even within this group. And what we really need is to know who in that so-called intermediate risk group that doesn't have microsatellite instability and doesn't have a T4 tumor, who is really at extremely high risk among those patients.
So again, you know, thinking about the breast cancer model, and you know, it's, we have to understand, we know that it's not exactly the same, but seems like there might be some similarities. And I guess the one thing, you know, I mean, as an education group, we get to hear the breast people, the colon people, lung, whatever, a lot of heme people, and, you know, try to put it all in perspective. And, you know, I guess in terms of actual people changing what they do, you know, as I said, it seems like the paradigm has already shifted in breast cancer, so it seems like it would be open. The one big difference I personally see, and I don't know whether you see as much of a difference, you know, in breast cancer, you're talking about taking a taxane or an anthracycline or both. And I don't know, to me, it seems just fundamentally different that one of your options in colon cancer is capecitabine alone.
Well, that is one of the options, and the benefit from capecitabine alone in high-risk patients and stage 3 patients is definitely a clinically meaningful benefit. Capecitabine is chemotherapy, but it is unlikely, as you've suggested, to have long-term side effects. And so in that sense, if you get through it, the likelihood is you'll go on living your life afterwards without any long-term effects. Really, the question is, who are the patients that, after taking 6 months of adjuvant chemotherapy of whatever type, who are the patients who will actually gain quality-adjusted survival on that basis, realizing that you lose some quality-adjusted survival or your quality of life during the period of adjuvant therapy is less than it would have been had you not received adjuvant chemotherapy, and you've got to make that up with downstream longer-term benefits from treatment. And one of the really cool things, I think, that we found in our decision model was that it's not only the risk of relapsing at 3 years that bears on whether or not somebody should get adjuvant therapy. It also matters how long is that person going to live otherwise? What is their life expectancy? Forget colon cancer. What would their life expectancy have been without colon cancer? Because remember, you're recouping a benefit over an entire lifespan. And what we found in our model was that the patients with the fewest life years remaining, it didn't matter how high their risk was of relapsing from colon cancer, they would never benefit from the use of adjuvant therapy in terms of quality-adjusted survival over their entire lifespan. On the other hand, the younger patient, the patient with more life years remaining, if you will, those patients were likely to benefit from adjuvant therapy over the course of a much longer lifespan, and at a given level of risk, it made more sense to treat more of those patients. And that's exactly what we observe in practice. If you look at practice patterns nationwide, older patients are less likely to get adjuvant therapy with stage 2 colon cancer than younger patients. And that's not age discrimination. That's not ageism. That's, in fact, according to our model, that's good medical care. That, in fact, you're more likely, if you have more life years remaining, to get a benefit from adjuvant therapy over your lifetime. Not in terms of your risk of relapsing at 3 years. We're talking now about over the entire lifespan.
So, you know, it's almost like a Talmudic discussion sometimes when you talk about adjuvant therapy of lower risk disease. I wasn't trying to promote capecitabine alone, just that it is interesting that that's one of the options, although I don't see too many people taking that option. Maybe more importantly, you're very involved in the clinical trials mechanism. What are some studies that are going on right now or that are being discussed and planned that might explore more, you know, these tissue predictors?
Sure. So we are definitely evolving into an era where it's going to be much more common to be assessing a tumor for various markers, classifiers, as part of your treatment assignment in clinical trials. And a lot of the discussion going on nationally among the Colon Cancer Task Force and GI Steering Committee is, what is our pathway to getting more bang for our buck and really advancing the field, advancing the care of our patients in a much more dramatic and less incremental way than we have been in the past? And I think there's a consensus brewing that we need to undertake studies with more novel study designs where treatment assignment based on predictive classifiers is the norm, where we bring investigational agents earlier on into the cooperative group setting, and where we use adaptive designs, adaptive statistical designs, where the assignment to a particular arm of a study might be weighted differently at different times during the study based on what's actually happened to patients before. And in this way, optimize the likelihood that a patient will be assigned to a treatment arm that's more likely to benefit them.
Starting to remind me a little bit of the battle study that was done in non-small cell and MD Anderson, where they did these biopsies and, you know, adjusted therapy based on the markers. What's actually going on right now in colon cancer? Are there trials like that?
Right now, we're in a period of discussion and planning. In early 2011, in January, the NCI convened a clinical trials planning meeting for colon and rectal cancer, and I was privileged to be one of the co-chairs of that meeting, in which we brought together about 100 clinical investigators, patient advocates, and other stakeholders to discuss the current state, where we've recently come from, and what do we need to do from the standpoint of clinical trial design to move forward? And really, those discussions have taken us in a direction where we're placing a greater emphasis on marker-directed studies in the next generation.
You know, one trial that I've been interested in, because again, kind of reminded me a little bit of a trial on breast cancer, the Taylor X study that was looking at how Oncotype played out in breast cancer. Now there's going to be one node positive. But there was a study, I think Al Benson's the head of it, from ECOG, where a big part of it, as I understood it, was collecting markers. And can you review that study and where it's at right now?
Of course. So you're referring to the ECOG 5202 study,
right?
I believe.
Yep.
Which was a study for patients with stage 2 colon cancer. And one of the objectives of that study was to validate whether you can identify a low-risk population based on microsatellite instability and 18q loss of heterozygosity. And so the patients with 18q loss of heterozygosity were presumed or hypothesized to be in a higher risk group, as was the group of patients who did not have microsatellite instability or deficient mismatch repair. And the way that study was designed is that the patients who enrolled would have their tumors assessed for microsatellite instability and loss of 18q, and the patients who were in the so-called low-risk group were just observed. So their material was banked for future research, and they were observed without adjuvant therapy. The patients in the higher-risk group were randomly assigned to either receive standard adjuvant therapy with FOLFOX, infusional 5-fluorouracil, leucovorin, and oxaliplatin, or FOLFOX plus bevacizumab. And what happened recently was based on emerging data suggesting that bevacizumab does not, in fact, add to the benefits of FOLFOX in the adjuvant setting. The ECOG 5202 study was recently closed to further accrual.
So are we going to be able to look at that for anything?
Yes, absolutely. So number one, there was a large number of patients who had already been accrued to the study. And so first of all, we're going to definitely be able to validate or refute the prognostic utility of deficient mismatch repair and 18q in the patients on this study. So that's number one. And number two, while the sample size in the randomized arm was not sufficient to have a high power, a high statistical likelihood of seeing a small difference with the use of bevacizumab, we will be able to do an exploratory analysis of whether bevacizumab did impact outcomes in the stage two population, realizing the other studies with bevacizumab were largely patients with stage three disease in the adjuvant setting. And in addition, there's now a pretty robust, pretty large tissue bank of patients with stage two colon cancer that can, with great clinical annotation and follow-up, that can be used to explore, discover, and potentially validate future prognostic markers as they come online.
Okay, I want to just get your quick take on a few other things, but just one more thing just to finish out in terms of genomic predictors. I guess I'd ask you if you could gather 100 consecutive cases of stage 2 colon cancer, what fraction of those, if an oncotype are done, might be, you know, useful in clinical decision-making? Most of them, none of them, or?
Yeah, I would say right now, it would be very few patients right now where a treatment decision is likely to be impacted by the use of one of these prognostic assays that's commercially available. On the other hand, as patients become more comfortable and doctors become more comfortable discussing the nuances of prognostic assays, as we become better at communicating what these results mean, there may be benefits to patients in terms of their decision-making and integrating these assays more commonly with their preferences in making treatment decisions. So do I think we have the perfect assay right now? No. But what we're learning is that we're learning, number one, what the perfect assay, what our aspiration should be in the perfect assay, how it might work, how we can best communicate these data to our patients, and what it would look like as we develop the next generation of these prognostic assays.
I just want to get your brief take on a couple other things, again, from the perspective of doc in practice. Curious what your thoughts are about what's been going on in gastric cancer. We found that very interesting over the last year or two, particularly in terms of the issue of HER2 positivity.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the HER2 discovery is really exciting in gastric cancer. And the magnitude of benefit of adding trastuzumab to chemotherapy in patients with HER2-positive gastric cancers is really huge compared to the benefits we've seen with other recent studies of new chemotherapy regimens. So I think that finding is really exciting, and that rapidly has become a standard of care in patients with advanced gastric cancer.
Let me just ask you, I'm curious, in your own shop, so to speak, is there a lot of discussion going on with the pathologist about what constitutes HER2 positivity in gastric as opposed to breast cancer?
At this point, we're pretty much using the same model as breast cancer and trying to interpret results in the context of the results from the gastric study as the assay was performed there.
What about pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's been some really exciting news in pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors recently, with two articles in the New England Journal of Medicine that show very dramatic benefits in terms of progression-free survival using new agents in pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. There was one study, which was a randomized study looking at sunitinib, and another looking at everolimus, and both of those agents showed really marked benefit in patients with pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors in terms of prolonging progression-free survival.
And where are things from a research perspective going there? What are some of the trial questions that are being asked right now?
Well, certainly an important question is, what if you combine these two agents that work on different pathways? The sunitinib, of course, is a VEGF inhibitor, but is a multi-targeted tyrosine kinase inhibitor. And the everolimus is an mTOR inhibitor. And there's a lot of interest in looking at whether the combination of these agents is safe and perhaps even more effective against neuroendocrine tumors.
What about HCC? You know, been a little while now since we heard about sorafenib. From the medical oncology perspective or treatment perspective, I don't know how involved you are with that. Usually there's some interdisciplinary group involved. Any thoughts about where that is?
Sure. I mean, I think that some of the interesting questions about HCC surround how best to integrate the new systemic approach that we have, sorafenib, with some of the regional approaches that have been used over the years and continue to expand. So, you know, we have regional approaches of sort of the classic chemoembolization approach, but there's radiofrequency ablation, there's yttrium-labeled microspheres, there is stereotactic radiosurgery, and the list keeps increasing. And I really think we need to apply the same level of rigor to understanding the benefits and potential harms of each of these regional approaches that we have to new systemic therapies in HCC.
The last thing I want to ask you about is something we've had a special interest in the last few years, done a lot of education work on. I don't think I've ever asked for your take on this, which is the issue of liver-only metastatic disease in colorectal cancer. It's kind of a unique situation, and there are a lot of interest in oncologists about that. Where are we right now in managing these patients, and what are some of the research issues that are out there?
So there's a clear understanding now that metastatic colon cancer is curable, period. And initially, maybe 15 years ago, we tended to focus on the number of liver metastases, how big they were. The reality is that surgeons now view the question of hepatic resection from the standpoint of what liver is going to be left after I resect the tumor. So the question really is not so much how many metastases are there, but if I resect all of these metastases, will there be enough viable liver remaining? And patients can be cured of metastatic colon cancer as long as the disease can be resected completely and, of course, with remaining sufficient viable liver.
I guess I've heard sort of a B to that premise, which is also assuming there's nothing that the tumor's abutting on, no critical structure that they can't sort of get around.
Sure, of course. And it's now become a standard practice to give chemotherapy, systemic therapy, in addition to hepatic resection, whether before and after, or simply after, is a more adjuvant approach. And it really, at this point, gets individualized from patient to patient. There is an ongoing national study looking at that question, and that study is called NSABP-C11. And that study is for patients who have liver metastases from colon cancer that are potentially resectable. And patients are randomly assigned to either get surgery followed by 6 months of adjuvant therapy, or to get half the adjuvant therapy before surgery and half the adjuvant therapy after surgery. And that question will hopefully help elucidate the sequencing of surgery and the systemic adjuvant.